services to seniors and people with disabilities will come to order. We don't have a full committee, but I think we'll get there at some point. And we're going to go ahead and start with the dialogue for Medicare Access Project. So, Bob, if you would come up and bring Dr. Baer and Dr. Janie Dunphy, would you please come up and introduce yourselves? Dr. Baer, I told you that we would have you here.
And you did.
And I did, right. And having spoken to a number of people about the problem, I know it is a real problem, and I'm not quite sure what the solution is, but we will try to arrive at one. So, Bob, you want to introduce yourself?
Well, thank you, Senator Morissette, and good morning to you and the rest of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to testify about a Medicare Access Project that will be carried out by the 50-plus Dialogue Advisory Board of Lake Oswego. For the record, my name is Bob Lawrence. I am speaking for Clackamas County Social Services and the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, since both are co-sponsoring this Medicare Access Project. The 50-plus Dialogue in Lake Oswego was carried out because the Lake Oswego Adult Center Advisory Board was concerned about the dwindling participation of members and volunteers. And Dr. Baer and myself and Janine Dunphy were on that advisory board, and we're very concerned about how the efficacy of the advisory board. So eventually it evolved into a 50-plus community dialogue about how efficacious is it, what kind of services do we provide, and that type of thing. As a result, the dialogue was with the community was a different and a unique way to do a survey of needs. As a result of the dialogues, a cadre of community leaders was developed. Because the scope of the dialogue went beyond the functioning of the adult center, the adult center advisory board was dissolved, and a larger community-based 50-plus dialogue advisory board was created to carry out the recommendations of the community dialogue and to continue to advise the city of Lake Oswego on the continued needs of seniors in our community. I have with me today two of the members of the 50-plus advisory board, and these individuals are very good examples. If you have a good volunteer program and something for them to do that is meaningful, you can get very, very good volunteers. Janine Dunphy is the chair of the advisory board, and Dr. Dan Baer, who has been spearheading this project. All three of us have been involved in the dialogue since the beginning. During the last legislative session, the Governor's Commission on Senior Services had a bill that was called the Baby Boomer Preparedness Act, which would have provided revenue for 2 to 4 pilot projects in the state to test the dialogue process in their communities. And I know that Senator Morissette was very instrumental in helping us with that particular bill. And we are still thinking that Senate Bill 1061 is an outcrop of all of the efforts that we have made in community dialogue. So I appreciate this opportunity to be able to brag about the 50-plus dialogue.
Good.
And Lake Oswego.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Morissette. We appreciate being here. You said you'd get us here, and here we are today.
Yes.
For the record, my name is Janine Dunphy, and I am the chair of the 50-plus advisory board. I am a longtime resident of Lake Oswego, and I am an independent insurance broker specializing in Medicare insurance and long-term care insurance. As Bob mentioned, our 50-plus board was formed in the fall of 2006 as a result of the community dialogues that were conducted in the city. Our mission remains to advise the City Council on issues that affect seniors. There are 4 key areas that we focus on. These areas came about as a result of the dialogue, and these are the areas that we've been looking at. They are maintaining independence, connected and intergenerational communities, meaningful service, and wellness. In 2007, which really was the first year of our board, we focused on several things. We moved forward a pilot shuttle service plan for seniors to increase mobility. We have supported a senior housing project that will enable seniors to stay in their in our city, the city that they've worked in. And we have recommended to City Council that they remove some of the permit processing barriers to allow people to build secondary dwelling units. We've worked on several volunteer issues to enable seniors to volunteer more and to help seniors. And then the area that we're here today to talk about is in the area of wellness and increasing the access to medical care. That was a very key area that came out of the series of dialogues, that there's an issue with that. So that's the project that Dr. Baer will now address. Thank you.
Dr. Baer.
My name is Dan Baer. I'm a retired physician living in Lake Oswego. Prior to my retirement, I was chief of laboratories and chief of pathology at the VA Medical Center, and prior to that, similar positions at Kaiser Permanente in Portland. My concern, or the concern that I'm addressing, is that people who become Medicare age frequently are finding that their physicians will no longer see them because of Medicare insurance. They're reluctant to take Medicare insurance. The Oregon Medical Association and Division of Human Services had a report prepared by the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research published this year that surveyed, among other things, physicians' acceptance of Medicare patients. And you can see on the chart, also in your handout, that in surveys in 2004 and 2006, approximately half of primary care physicians in Oregon would had limitations on the numbers of Medicare patients they would accept, or they would accept no Medicare patients. We realize that this is a serious problem that has many causes. The root cause, of course, is inadequate Medicare reimbursement, and we're not here to address that problem. We do see a solvable problem in providing information to individuals so that they can find a physician who will accept Medicare patients. There is no system currently in the state that allows a person who needs a physician who will accept Medicare to know which physicians will accept Medicare patients. We think that some sort of a central information source is needed. And to that end, we as the 50-plus advisory board are putting together a meeting to try to solve this problem. We have contacted the Foundation for Medical Excellence, which has agreed to facilitate a meeting in Portland, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Oregon Medical Association, Providence Medical Groups, and Legacy Medical Groups have expressed an interest in trying to solve this problem with us. And in the next month, we expect to have a meeting, a working meeting, to try to solve the problem. I have no idea what the solution is. I don't know whether there is a legislative remedy. I suspect that the remedy will be in the private sector, a cooperative arrangement that these groups will work out. And that's where we are. Our purpose for being here today was to make you aware of the problem and make you aware of the work we're doing to try to solve the problem.
Okay. The groups that are providing Medicare supplemental insurance, and I believe there are 17 IPAs around the state. In Lane County, it's LIPA, and the group, there are a variety of insurance coverage. Have you spoken to Care Oregon, for instance? Have you spoken to some of those?
No, the only insurance group that we've spoken to at this point is Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Okay.
We are looking to try to find a local solution in the Lake Oswego, Portland area as a pilot that might be a model that could be adopted elsewhere in the state if it's successful.
Some of the members of our support group dealing with senior long-term care, it seems to me, could address this issue. Barry Donnefeld, for instance, who does, you know, he's the head of an organization that of AAAs that have are in contact with. Well, Care Oregon would be one organization, and it just seems to me that the people who provide the insurance should be able to tell you which physicians to go to. Now, are physicians reluctant to be on a list as accepting Medicare? That's the other question. They may want the flexibility of saying, no, we don't accept, under what circumstances. Now, we're having an issue with some assisted living facilities who no longer or who do not want to accept Medicaid people. However, if we increase the rate, which we're going to do, and if we allow them to select a certain number of Medicaid patients without having to accept more than they feel they can handle, some of them are willing to do that. I understand the state of Washington does that. There is a cap on people that they accept. And it is true, I understand, that once people reach that Medicare age, that their doctor says, we don't take you anymore, and they have to find a new physician. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, I think it's something that we definitely need to work on, and I would like to continue our conversation, and I would like to talk with some of the IPA organizations around the state and find out if they have, what their feeling is. And
I suspect that within each of these insurance groups, they will have a small group. They will have a group of their providers that they can refer people to. The problem, though, for people who are not covered by one of these insurance groups still remains. And many hospitals, for instance, will have referral services to physicians, and that would be one source of information.
Okay. Something that would be helpful is the worst-case scenario anecdotal information. Do you have worst-case scenario anecdotal information about someone who was denied access to a physician?
We have one sitting here.
Oh, you're a living example, right?
I'm a living example.
Wow, and you are living, though, right?
Yeah. I got spoiled, Senator Morissette, because I was a state employee and I had wonderful health insurance. So then when I retired, of course, and got Medicare, I was naive.
Uh-huh.
I thought it would just be automatic, and then I started to look for a physician, and I couldn't find one that would take Medicare. And my daughter, Kristen, knew somebody at Providence, and she knew somebody, a doctor that was spinning off on his own, who was going to set up his own practice in gerontology and naturopath. And so I went with him, and after about a year, he had to go out of business because the Medicare reimbursement was not enough. I was back to the point where I had to look for a physician. So I went to Providence, and they gave me this wonderful book, like, these are the people that you should contact in your community. I contacted at least six of them. They said, we do not take Medicare. We have a waiting list if you want to be on the waiting list. But we've reached our cap.
Wow.
We've reached our cap, so we can only take so many Medicare to make it viable. And at the last Governor's Commission meeting, I finally went with the managed care, and I've been extremely grateful, and I'm pleased with Kaiser. And I don't have to worry about that stuff, and they did take me unknown questions. But at the last Governor's Commission meeting, you heard one of our commissioners say that he had had the same physician for about 20 years, and then he's turning 65, and his physician let him know that he would not be able to provide him services anymore. So this problem is, what I wanted was a physician in my own community, and I couldn't find one. And this, you can tell this tale all across the board, all across the state. I think, Dr. Baer, did you mention that 60% of the physicians in this state will not take Medicare?
Yeah. There are different numbers that come around. The most recent report says 50%, but still it's... Okay. It's a very large number.
Well, we're going to be interesting. We're going to be talking rural health care in just a moment, and assistance that we do give to physicians to take care of their malpractice situation. And it'd be interesting to see if we have any requirements on them to do this.
Senator Morrison, yeah. I was wondering here, when Janine was giving her information about her background, she said she was a broker for insurance companies for long-term care insurance, and your eyes kind of went up like that. Do you have any questions of her on long-term care insurance? Because she'd like to preach to you about...
No. that's not my...
Well, getting back to your 50-plus organization and the things that you're doing in your community, that is exactly what we are going to be doing during this interim and next session, because we need to make sure that communities work together to provide points of entry into long-term care and all of the related issues, which is access to their physicians. And if you guys are having to go to a different community, think of the people in John Day or Elgin, that their clinic is ready to close because they can't, you know, they don't have the wherewithal to survive. So there are some real access issues. Senator Cruz.
A question, and I apologize for being late. Are we seeing in those communities where the IPAs are getting into the Medicare Plus benefit models, are we seeing an improvement in access?
I don't know. I have no information.
Ms. Chair, I think that's something worth exploring, because there are communities that are getting into the business, and or where the IPAs are getting into the business. And I mean, I've got some anecdotal stuff from my community where access is improving, and simply because the physicians are vested. So
now that's a managed care. Which
right.
is what you
well, that's
got
managed
in.
Care, obviously.
Yeah, well, and what Bob was saying is that he was forced to go into managed care. Now, he preferred to keep his own physician, but I guess those are individual physician decisions, and I don't know what we could do about that unless that was part of the contractual agreement with rural physicians who receive additional money to pay their malpractice in rural Oregon. I don't know if that's...
Well, Ms. Chair, I mean, this is what's happening in Oregon currently and in other states. It's market-driven, and which is obviously the best scenario if the market takes us to a place rather than us trying to force somebody to a place. But I think some experience data on how that's impacting access, I think, might be beneficial.
That's something that we do want to look at, and is how it is impacting access. So,
thank you very much, Senator.
Yeah, and thank you,
Senator.
Thank
Bruce.
You very much for
it's
being.
It's really
here.
Been great,
and we'll continue this discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Okay. Okay. Rural health.
If people don't know if it's all going to come up. Yes, Chris Davey and Peter Merck with SAFE. Corey with ECBS and then Scott. Maybe all four of them can come up.
Okay. Corey, would you please come up? And I know Chris.
We both with SAFE.
Okay, Peter Merkin.
Or I think Chris Davis.
Yeah, Chris, why don't you guys come up, and you'll have to
pull up another chair if you want.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and happy to be here to talk a little about the medical malpractice program for rural medical care providers. And I'm going to just do a little bit of background. I know you're familiar with this bill, but on the other hand, it's been a few months since you've had the opportunity to think about it. So
now, let me interrupt for just a moment. Thank you very much for being here. Is this, are there other states that are doing this or anything like it?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that Pennsylvania was looking at it, and I think one other state. I'm not aware of any other states that have actually.
Now, one of the reasons I'm asking, because I am going to attend a National Legislative Conference, NCSL, in April, the end of April, and this is their topic, rural health, access to physicians in rural health. And so, I want to take some of our successes back there, but it's...
And, Mr. Chair, I'm looking at our staff in the background. Do we, in the room, do we know whether any other states have, in fact, implemented this program?
No, we do not know.
Yeah.
Right now,
okay.
We will certainly
I don't know that other states have access to the generosity of SAFE. So. I don't know if that's...
That would actually be state funds.
Yeah.
Okay. Through SAFE.
Yeah. If SAFE's exporting dollars, that could be an issue.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry for interrupting.
We're here to answer whatever questions that you have.
Okay.
This program, I'm sure you recall, was implemented to begin with in 2003 when we were facing some significantly increased workers' compensation, medical malpractice insurance costs. Distracted me with the SAFE reference. And we were looking for a way to provide relief, particularly to rural practitioners and particularly highest priority to those providing obstetric services. And so the original program provided a pool of money actually through SAFE, but with a credit against workers' compensation premium assessments to provide those subsidies. And that program, I think we all felt, was successful. It provided a benefit to rural physicians, reducing their costs for malpractice insurance. In 2007, however, I think the legislature felt and we all felt that some fine-tuning was needed to make sure that the program was targeted correctly at meeting the needs that it was intended to address. And in addition, the expenditures under the program had not been as high as we had projected, and therefore there were funds still remaining in the set-aside that we had put in place in 2003. So the intent of the 2007 legislation was to continue the program, more finely tune the program, and also work at extending it for another 4 years. So the changes put in place in 2007. The original bill provided a subsidy of up to 80% for obstetricians and those up to 60% for family practitioners whose practice included obstetrics, and up to 40% for everybody else. The 2007 changes fine-tuned the definition of who was considered rural, and the major impact of that change was to exclude Ashland, although the bill also included those who provide obstetric services in Ashland. Those who provide obstetrics were continued at the 80% level and 60% for family practitioners, including obstetrics. But those who provided, there was then a further fine-tuning of the tiers so that those in primary care fields, which were specified, had got the subsidy level up to 40% based on their 2007 insurance rates. But those providing non-primary care specialties received a declining percentage subsidy over the four-year period. We also, in relation to the topic you were just discussing, the bill also included a requirement that in order to be eligible, a physician had to have their practice open to serving Medicare and Medicaid patients.
Thank you.
That was subject of considerable discussion for exactly the reasons that, that you've just been discussing, and we can talk about what we're seeing as a result of that. In addition, in recognition of the role of nurse practitioners in rural Oregon, nurse practitioners providing medical care in rural areas were also included in the bill, and that, of course, also includes nurse midwives. And then, finally, there was some discussion of physicians whose insurance is provided through hospitals. The bill, it was intended for those who pay their insurance premiums themselves, but some non-employee physicians do receive coverage through hospitals, and so there was a small carve-out to allow, under certain circumstances, physicians receiving their coverage through healthcare facilities to participate. So that was the structure that that you put in place in the 2007 session. Now, that went into effect just in January of this year, so we don't have a lot of experience yet, but Mr. Davies is going to talk a little about what we have seen in the couple of months since those changes have been implemented. And I should say, in the context of the bigger picture market, insurance, and particularly this type of liability insurance, tends to be cyclical. And when we first implemented this program in 2003, we were in the midst of a classic, what's called a hard market, insurance rates going up. We are now in a soft market cycle. And indeed, rates have come down. And so there is some hope on the horizon. It is cyclical. Sooner or later, they will undoubtedly go back up. But I think the most recent rate filing did show around an 8 or 9% decrease. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, but you may want to hear from others first.
We're not projecting into the next biennium yet. We're just as far as continuing the program. I'm not sure that.
I believe it's a little early. We have a requirement to report to the legislature at the beginning of next session. So we will have close to a year's worth of data at that time, and we will then be able to give you a little more sense of what we're seeing.
Okay, good. Thanks. Chris, you want to?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation, and with me is Peter Merck. He's the manager of our Research and Analysis Division, and we're the mechanical part of this program. Peter does this, and he knows far more of the details than I do. So if you have any really hard questions, I'll look at Peter and him answer them. I'm passing around testimony. Covers a lot of the same areas that Corey has already spoken about, and so I just really want to pick out a few points there. This program has been in place now since 2004. It was 2003 legislative session that enacted the original bill. And originally it was expected that it would cost $40 million to do this for 4 years, and it would expire at the end of 2007. The criteria were laid out as to which kinds of medical providers could be a part of the program, what it meant to be rural, actually as defined by the Office of Rural Health, the requirement that a provider be insured by an authorized insurance carrier and have professional liability insurance policy that was within certain limits. And as Corey pointed out, there were specified subsidies, if you like, for the for the medical malpractice premiums that those providers were paying, 80%, 60%, and 40%. Through the end of 2007, we had reimbursed somewhere between 1,150 and 1,200 physicians. We haven't quite finalized the numbers yet for the end of 2007. But in the neighborhood of up to 1,200 different doctors had received some money from this program during the initial 4 years. And we do know that we have spent $21.3 million. So the original expectation was a $40 million program.
Oh.
And for some of the reasons that Corey already referred to, it actually came in quite a bit lower.
Yeah.
As far as how that money is distributed, again, we don't have the most recent data there, but as of late in 2006, out of that $21 million, about 25% of those dollars went to obstetricians. About 11% went to family practitioners who provide obstetrical services, and the other 64% went to other specialties that were practicing in a rural area. Because the money was lasting a lot longer than originally anticipated, the 2007 legislature reenacted the program, if you like, for an additional 4 years, and so it's now scheduled to run through the end of 2011.
Okay.
And rather than spending an average of $10 million a year, as the original bill said, it was modified to say that we will spend an average of $5 million, so that $40 million will now be spent over a full eight-year period. As Corey mentioned, there were some concerns about where the money was being spent and how it could be spent more effectively, and there had to be some tweaking of the program to make the $40 million run through that eight-year period, too. I think Corey already spoke about most of those changes. There was sort of a grandfathering provision included in the bill, too, so that if you were eligible at when the program began in 2004, you would stay in through the length of that program if you were in a community that was qualified initially. What we had found is that a population center of 30,000 was a threshold, and some cities in Oregon were very close to 30,000. One year they had a 29,500 population, and then they annexed some more land, and now they had 30,300. Well, we didn't want to see
Grants Pass.
There you go.
Now, Grants Pass is in. Right?
Through this grandfathering provision, yes. Grants Pass was going to be moved out, but the bill actually had an emergency clause and it kept them in.
Well, Grants Pass is in and Ashland is out.
That's correct. Ashland is out except for obstetricians.
I know, and we made sure that they stayed in.
That's correct.
Yeah. I still don't understand why they're out, but that's okay.
So, We write a plan about how this is administered. The plan is approved by DCBS. We completed that in November and got the thing rolling under the new plan. As of earlier this week, we had 843 physicians who are currently enrolled and eligible to receive money out of the program. 61 of those are family physicians who provide obstetrical services. 46 of them are obstetricians. So those are physicians who are currently in the program. In addition, we signed up 42 nurse practitioners who would not have been eligible under the program through the end of last year, and 7 of those 42 are certified in obstetrics. And if you're following along, these numbers are in the middle of page 4.
Yeah.
The Ashland physicians that moved out, 63 physicians who had received money through that program through the end of 2007 are no longer eligible.
Now, excuse me for interrupting. What about the glide path out? I mean, are there physicians that are going to be phased out?
The glide, Mr. Chair and committee members, the glide path did not affect the Ashland physicians. They were removed January 1.
Yeah,
The glide path is this decreasing percentage of reimbursements for the specialties that were not laid out in the bill. There are, I think, 12 specialties altogether that will continue to receive the same level of reimbursement as they did under the old program. But others, such as plastic surgeons, for example, who might be practicing in somewhere other than Ashland, are on this glide path that brings them down to, I think, the 15%. Final figure is 15% in 2011 from the 40% that they had received before.
I see. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Chris, your testimony said the exclusion was urbanized areas of Jackson County. So does that mean those practicing obstetrics in Medford are also eligible?
though, Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, if they are practicing obstetrics in Medford, they would not be eligible because Medford is...
I realize this generalization, but it said urbanized areas of Jackson County, which I believe Medford would qualify as an urbanized area of Jackson County.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, this gets into technical language that the U.S. Census uses. First of all, we determine what is rural, and to be rural, you have to be more than 10 miles from a city of 30,000 population, but yet within a rural area, you can have an urbanized area, and Ashland, under the U.S. Census criteria, was classified as an urbanized area, so that's why the phraseology in the bill is written that way.
So what would Medford be classified as?
Not rural in the first place, because it's over 30,000 population.
Okay, so this is urbanized rural area. Okay.
Something like that.
So what's the population of Ashland that it's an urban area? Scott, do you know?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health.
Yeah.
And the population of Ashland, I believe, is about 20,000.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're talking about in determining eligibility is the state's definition of rural, and then you overlay on top of that the federal definition of urbanized areas. So Medford would be excluded based on the state's definition, and then Ashland is excluded based on the federal definition. The reason Ashland is considered an urbanized area is because of its proximity to Medford.
Right. 11 miles, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Thank you.
The only other thing that I wanted to briefly mention is that we do perform audits of this program. We have had some overpayments, but we've been very successful in recovering those overpayments. And after we did our first audit, we found $46,000 that was owing back to the program.
Oh.
And we've been successful in recovering every part of that but for $320. So we're making sure the money is spent appropriately, and the bill that was passed last year seems to make it possible for that program to run fully funded through 2011. If we realize getting close to the end of the program that we're running short of money, there are provisions built into the bill to back off some of those percentages of reimbursement just so the money will last through the end of the period.
Mr. Chair, one of the arguments we had last session was and I still think, and hopefully when we get the report at the beginning of next session, and I was reluctant to want to go that route and throw more money in rather than back off the rates. So hopefully we can have a pretty fair idea of what the track will be, so that, well, and actually, you know, it would, we'll be back, or some will be back in 2011, and we could probably still make adjustments there, but it'd be helpful not to have to back off if the amount of additional dollars is de minimis to stay where we're at. So,
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Senator Cruz, we will have some data, of course, by the beginning of the 09 session, but a lot of this is dependent on how insurance rates trend. So we will clearly have a lot more accurate information by the time 2011 rolls around.
Now, I wonder if there's discussion within the big bubble of Senate Bill 329 in terms of continuing the program, and I discussed this with Dr. Bates at one point. That's what he indicated, is that that might be a way at, you know, when we do the big overhaul of the health program, that there could be some inclusion. Other than that, I don't know that we're counting on, well, as Senator Cruz says, if we're going to come up with new money to extend the program beyond 2011, I don't know. Now, anecdotal information. Scott, do you have any, aside from the physician and his wife that moved here from Tennessee and are currently practicing in Pendleton, is that correct?
And Senator, you came up with that anecdotal information. It's the best I've heard yet.
Oh, wow.
But I
can assure you that I talked with the spouse of this female doctor who was very happy to be here, and they did end up in Pendleton, and that's where I as far as I know, they're still there.
It's a great success story. They're providing very much needed services in Pendleton. I thought it might be interested, or it might be interesting to look at, because one of the purposes of this program is to retain physicians in the community, particularly those that are doing obstetrics, to compare it to sort of the trends that we see through the state income tax credit program. As you probably know, the Office of Rural Health helps to administer the state income tax credit program for rural providers. While we're seeing a pretty steady level of people who are receiving that benefit, we're seeing approximately the same thing with the medical malpractice reinsurance program. So while we can't say with any certainty that there's a causal relationship between this program and retention of physicians in rural communities, I think we could probably say that the feared departure of providers from rural Oregon is not happening. The evaluation of the program that was done and presented during the last legislative session by Dr. Errol Smits talked about the fact that a lot of obstetricians or family practice physicians who were doing obstetrics had pretty much already either stopped doing it or had decided to stop doing it before the benefit of this program was realized. And so I think we should still keep an eye on availability of obstetrical services in rural Oregon. But at this point, we're seeing about the same, roughly the same numbers from one year to the next.
Okay. Mr. Merck, did you?
I don't have anything to add unless the committee has questions of me on the technical side of the program.
Any report on the nurse practitioners yet? Do you know how many? Well, does it say how many nurse practitioners are involved?
Mr. Chair, we have 42 nurse practitioners,
okay.
Seven of whom are certified in obstetrics.
Okay. So that went into effect in January, right? I mean, we're waiting.
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
And this is a little bit off to the side, but since Scott is here, a question came up in another committee and didn't get a chance to ask it. They're about rural physicians. Is there data or any research to show that as we maintain physicians in, or they move out to rural communities, it becomes like a magnet or a kind of a foothold that grows a greater medical community? I mean, if you keep doctors there, if they move out, do you get a greater number of other healthcare professionals relocating to the area when it starts? Or you understand the question does it become a magnet? Is it worth investing in trying to get footholds in local communities to grow the?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Rakovian, the data that we would have comes from an analysis of the economic impact of health care systems in a rural community. And it is clear that there is data that shows that for every physician that's in a community, they employ three other people to keep the practice going. And then if you add a hospital to the mix, and, you know, so there are data like that, none specific to Oregon necessarily, but great parallel examples of what the situation is in other states. And there are some national studies that have Oregon statistics in them. We haven't looked closely enough to tell whether we think they're comprehensive or not, but it I guess that's a long way of saying it's very much a good economic investment to keep the healthcare system going.
I would hope that we can make that economic investment into an economic development issue and use lottery dollars, for instance, to invest in workforce issues in rural Oregon. We've had a bill that talked about cigarette tax to do some of that work, but I've met with the governor's office several times during the interim last time and talked about it, an economic development issue. You know, if you want to maintain the business community viable, the viability, then, you know, it's important to have adequate health care. And so I think that's extremely important. What's the tax credit for physicians? Is it still $5,000?
Yes, sir.
And what categories of
what's the scope of that?
It is all physicians, all nurse practitioners, all physician assistants, and subsets of dentists, optometrists, podiatrists. I think that about covers it.
Okay. Now, that is it a 5,000 per each category that you mentioned, or are there different levels of...
Up to $5,000.
Oh, up to. Oh, I see.
Right. Some of those folks don't accrue a $5,000 state income tax debt, so that's why some get a lower credit than others.
I see. Now, has that been a successful way of... attracting, keeping?
It's been very successful, particularly when the program was implemented. It was implemented in 1989, or it was authorized in 1989, and of course in that time $5,000 was quite a bit of money. I think that it may have been somewhat helpful in recruiting people, and I know that it was really lauded as a national model. I think at this point in time, because the value of the dollar has decreased a bit and because there has been no increase in that credit, I think it's serving now more as a retention tool than anything else. And we surveyed our constituents probably about the year 2000, and we asked them about the tax credit program. One of the things that surprised us was the number of people who wrote in and said, you know, the financial value is good, you know, it's a good thing. It wouldn't convince me to come here, but what does really, what it does say to me as a provider is that the state has recognized that it's a different story to practice in a rural community, and that they're willing to invest and value our service to rural communities. So,
oh, good. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Scott, don't go away. Okay. We are going to now deal with, Dr. Leslie Halleck. Would you come up, please? Oregon Health and Sciences University Rural Health. Okay, Leslie, we're going to zero in on the rural health workforce, among other things.
Thank you, Chairman Morissette, Senator Cruz, Senator Courtney, and Administrator Bacobian. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. President Robertson was scheduled to be here, and as I've shared with the chairman, he came down with a very bad case of the flu last night and called me and asked if I would serve in his stead. He regrets very much that he's not here and had planned to be. We want to share with you the impact of the current TORC cap decision on our rural health programs. And the bottom line, before I go through a little bit of the detail, is that they are not very impacted. There are a couple of exceptions, but overall, most of the programs, by far the lion's share of the programs, are intact. So I want to make sure that message is heard first, and then I'll provide some of the details and, of course, answer any questions. We still have more than a couple of hundred outreach and community service programs. All the Dornbecker programs that see provide traveling clinics to over 1,800 kids in specialty areas are intact. The CDRC Cocoon program, which goes statewide, is intact, has not been impacted. The Poison Center, which takes 70,000 calls a year from all over the state, is intact and not affected. Physician Consult Service, again, 33,000 calls, not impacted. The Office of Rural Health, and Scott is here and can answer anything, it turns out, but can talk to you about any of the detail, was transferred to OHSU in 1989 with an annual budget of $300,000. Since that time, the overall state budget to OHSU, as you know, has been reduced on about eight occasions by 10 to 20% in each case. The Office of Rural Health current budget that we provided is, even after the TORC cap decision, is over $450,000. So we have not reduced it. We've added to it significantly. It's still inadequate, and they've been handed many additional tasks for very good reasons, and those have not been funded, come with any funding for the office. They leverage that and obtain over $700,000 in federal funds each year, and that helps them do those jobs. But it's an amazing efficient office in terms of what it gets done for the investment that's been made in it. Similar story could be told about the area health education centers and what they've been able to accomplish.
Excuse me. Sure. What about grants in addition to the state and federal funding? Are there grants that come to the Office of Rural Health through OHSU?
The federal funding is a grant. It's actually a couple of grants, and so that is those are grants that the office obtains from the federal agencies. So those are the main grants.
One of the interesting conferences that I attended several years ago dealing with rural health was communities' viability grants. Well, Senator Cruz introduced a bill a couple of years ago to establish viability grants, which have never been funded, and that's the thing we come back for every year. But, and I have talked to the Ford Family Foundation, and I've talked to various other granting places saying, why don't you go into a community and help to do a viability grant to establish, you know, it's an economic development kind of thing and just a community building thing and so on. And I still hope that if we can get some money into the viability grants as seed money to expand that to the private sector. You know, there are a lot of these, you know, healthcare funding organizations that I think if they see that the state is willing to put some viability money in, that they might be willing to do that too. So we don't have those kinds of grants.
Well, the federal funding is in that category, but from private foundations, the Ford Family Foundation has helped primarily, primarily in educational programs. So not so much providing clinical service, but in educational programs in rural communities.
Well, I think a viability grant has to have choices attached to it. I mean, you know, if it's health related, it could be, you know, there's got to be some flexibility to suit the people who give the grants, because some of them are very specific in what they will, you know, give money for.
Senator Morissette, we're just beginning, and members of the committee, we're just beginning to look at foundations for source of some additional revenue, and we actually have a concept paper pending with one of the foundations. But we haven't in the past ever had private.
I would really like to see what you have, because I think that's something we have to continue working on. And again, I'm in this conference that I'm going to, we're going to be talking about rural health. And why I first heard about this is in West Virginia, and there was a state senator there talking about how successful their grant program was for these small communities. And it started on a very small level, a little bit of state money, and then pretty soon foundations came in. Now, I talked to Karen Whitaker about that, and she said at that time they were focusing on the southeastern part of the country, and it was a multi-state grant because they needed the most help. And Karen said, well, we weren't considered an area of need at the time. You know, but so I would like to go back to that kind of scenario and see if we can't get something, because we are an area of need. So, anyway.
One of the areas where we have received foundation support for areas and activities in rural communities are in the area of ethics and end-of-life care.
Okay.
And through the Ethics Center, they've actually received funding to deliver help to everything from assisted living and nursing home type facilities to rural hospitals around kind of serving the wishes of elderly patients in rural communities. So there's some grants that are very targeted to end-of-life issues that have been obtained.
Could you please get me information
Absolutely.
About that?
Sure.
Yeah.
But what I did want to share with you at your request was were some of the specific impacts that have resulted from the tort cap Supreme Court decision. When we were faced December 28th with that decision, it immediately had an impact of approximately $30 million a year on our budget. We had just finished a 5-year financial plan to assure everyone, ourselves included, that OHSU was on a strong financial footing. And that financial plan consisted primarily of things like productivity, efficiencies, basically trying to make sure we were doing everything as well as we could. But we could not then absorb an additional $30 million a year with that sort of approach. We really had to look at programs and how many could we sustain. The number $30 million was derived by a variety of things that work with underwriters, work with insurance companies directly, work with actuarial experts. We subsequently received a bill, literally, for our reserving and insurance for this fiscal year of $17 million for the time from December until June. So we think the $30 million number was actually very close to what it's really going to cost us. So what we did very quickly, because it was upon us immediately, was look at all the essential services that we provide and only OHSU provides and protected those. That was kind of the first thing we did. And then we looked at everything else to try and see how it could be sustained. Specifically, the School of Nursing, and I'll use that as an example. The first thing we did is look at the base function of providing workforce ready nursing graduates. The legislature provided us with 4 new initiatives in the last session on top of our base nursing support. And those 4 are, they increased the base production by 50 students a year. They added to it some funding for what we call OCNI, which is a consortium that is a partnership with community colleges of 100 students a year, where we educate those students after they complete training on the community college campuses on those sites, so they can obtain a baccalaureate on the community colleges across the state. Those are intact, both of those. A new campus at Western Oregon University, which is and I'm not saying this just because Senator Courtney is here, an absolutely delightful experience. Western has been a phenomenal partner in this, and it is ready to go, actually ahead of schedule. So that program is off and running, and we'll have students enrolled in the fall. And we increased graduate programs specifically to target nurse educators because the teacher shortage is so acute. So those 4 programs have been protected and will be continued. But the nursing school also did a lot of other things, and they're all wonderful things. Many of them provide services that are badly needed, but they are not absolutely required to deliver the graduate the graduates that we produce for the workforce. Examples are the clinic in Elgin, the clinic in Union, some student support in various schools, a variety of contracts that they deliver to prisons, their services that they render.
Now, wait, you mentioned 2 hot-button towns.
I know, on purpose.
Okay.
And when we looked at those operations, which were basically School of Nursing programs, they were run by employees of the School of Nursing, they were losing money, substantial amounts of money in each case. We cannot sustain that. So what we've done, thanks to the incredible energy of Scott and his team in the Office of Rural Health, and to Lisa Dodson, the director of the Area Health Education Center, is we're going into those communities, working with the communities, which have been terrific, by the way. They've really mobilized to try and see if those clinics can be restructured to be made viable without the subsidy that we have been providing. And Lisa herself, the director of the AHEC, is a family practitioner. You may know, used to practice in John Day. We have long had an interest in launching a locum tenens program. She viewed this as a pilot for the locum tenens, so she says, I have a solution for the short term for Elgin. And literally all winter, she has been driving to Elgin, and she herself is practicing in that clinic 2 days a week, providing care, because we had been unable to recruit providers. So we're sort of with a lot of Band-Aids holding those clinics together right now, with a lot of help from the office.
Now, there is another Band-Aid that we're working on, because we do have a bill that went to Ways and Means with the fiscal, and that would provide wraparound payments within a timely manner of 45 days. That would certainly help Union and Elgin and so on. And I'm asking Scott to get some specific information on the need and what will happen if we can get that help or not get that help. And I'm also asking the department, Mr. Edge, to get specific information about what that fiscal impact consists of, so we know where those dollars are, whether or not those are dollars that actually belong to those clinics through repayments and are not being paid and so on. So now that those clinics are also doing a hospital district, is that right?
Mr. Chair,
I apologize, I did interrupt what you were saying. But go ahead.
That's one solution that the community of Elgin seems to be embracing, and that is to put a measure on the ballot to see if the citizenry will create a health district to help subsidize the clinic. A little too early to tell whether that's the route that will be taken in Union.
Okay. But that wouldn't help them immediately.
No.
Yeah, that's correct. I'm sorry.
No, that's exactly why Scott is here. Yeah. The our goal is twofold. We would first like to find a way for those clinics to stay open and continue to provide services. I don't think necessarily having OHSU run those clinics is the best solution, and clearly having us subsidize them isn't a good long-term solution. But they have rural health clinic status, which puts them in a position to obtain a favorable reimbursement structure federally. And if they were closed, even temporarily, they would lose that status, and when you reopen them, they may or may not be able to re-obtain it. And I think Scott's advice has been that, in fact, they probably would not. And so that's why we're going through such heroics, frankly, and why Dr. Dodson is driving out there in the middle of winter 2 days a week to try and keep them open while we work with the communities to look at things like hospital districts. There's an alliance of providers in North Powder, Cove, and Union that are all working on the Union solution, and the two communities are actually working together to see if there are any joint kinds of solutions that might be worked out. So we're working hard with those, but there's a running rate subsidy that we're providing that we cannot continue to provide indefinitely. So that's where we are on those.
Okay.
I want to say just a word about the School of Medicine and then close. I think the School of Medicine, one of the burning issues as we look down the road in the next decade is the physician workforce shortage. And we have taken the class size up to 120 with one-time help from the legislature in this biennium. And we said at the time that we could sustain it after that. We are not sure we can sustain it. With this tort cap decision, and so what we're being a little bit more cautious in this next admission cycle. We're going to drop it to 115. We're not dropping it all the way back, but we're going to drop it a little bit. And the specific issue is training sites, clinical training sites. We're now spending a substantial amount of money, several hundred thousand, maintaining additional training sites across the state for this additional cohort, hoping to ramp it up to 160 in partnership with the major universities in the OUS system. We'll come back in the 09 session with a discussion of what we're affectionately calling ORMED 2 or ORMED 2009, but this is a program that's a partnership with U of O, OSU, and now includes Portland State as well, to try and expand the class size. But we're going to have to be very cautious there and make sure that we have adequate support before we can really.
Now, what about, for instance, in Lane County, we have Peace Health, which is a very large hospital, and I talked to Mary Spilde, the president of Lane Community College, and they had, they raised their foundation $5 million in the state, put in $5 million to build a facility for training. The solution to staffing was that perhaps the nurse trainers, teachers, would work for the hospital as well as for the community college, because the community colleges can't pay them enough. They have a cap on their negotiated salaries, and so the combination of the hospital, is Lane County involved in this?
Absolutely. Lane Community College has been one of the key OCNE partners from the beginning in the nursing partnership, and they were one of the early adopters, actually, and have rolled out that program. It's true that the educators, the teachers, are really hard to come by because those graduate nurses can earn a better living, frankly, practicing. And that's a great program where they can do both and really capture them. In some of the smaller rural areas, they haven't had the wherewithal to do that, and that's why the initiative that you all funded last session is very helpful. And we've talked, actually, quite a bit with the Office of Rural Health about the possibility of, in the next session, asking to include nurse educators, not just practitioners, in the tax credit, so that they would have a little help and a little incentive, frankly, to stay teaching at least part of the time. Mm-hmm. The Union Clinic and Elgin Clinic are relevant here because in La Grande, very often our faculty, who are also often nurse practitioners, will practice in those clinics as well as teach. Oh. And the difficulty now in just the workforce shortage in recruiting people is another kind of exacerbating factor in trying to keep these clinics open, and why we've thrown some of our own people in the mix to try and
see. The thing that to me is totally mind-boggling is because the economic development, you know, the governor is interested in economic development. We have healthcare workforce people who earn a living wage. You know, nurses earn a family living wage, and yet we have a huge nursing shortage. And I've never been able to figure out why there is not a connection. It's an infrastructure. Part of it is it's training, it's all of these separate pieces, but why we don't consider it economic development and train people to earn a living wage job in rural communities to attract business and other people there is still beyond me. I don't understand it.
Well, Chairman Morrison, I couldn't agree more. This is definitely the choir here. The capacity to train is the rate-limiting step. The jobs exist already, that it's a wonderful economic development issue in one sense. And in the last session, you really expanded that capacity significantly. So if we can continue to deliver that, we will at least make a dent in some of those issues, as long as we can stay on track and continue to do it. And frankly, that's why some of these additional things we do are at risk with that $30 million reduction, is because we're trying to sustain that educational core and just up the production of those practitioners. Some states have actually gone to salary supplements for nurse educators specifically to kind of keep them in the teaching workforce. I'm not proposing that this time. I don't even know if it's a good solution for Oregon, but it is a national issue, that competition between teaching and practice. So I'd be happy to answer questions. What I want to leave you with is a clear message, and that is that we remain very committed to rural health care. We are not reducing our commitment to distribute education and workforce production across the state. We can't continue to do all the things we've been doing, and we're going to have to look very carefully at each thing.
Do you train psychiatric nurses at OHSU?
We do have a mental health nurse practitioner program, and we have a mental health component in the undergraduate curriculum. That's a huge shortage area, and a lot of the programs, ours included, that are training nurses are looking at it really with fresh eyes. Are we doing the best way? Because there's such a need, and the current methods of production are not going to be adequate.
My good friend from Lane County, Dr. Roy Orr, is the new director of the mental hospital, and he will be in touch with you, because I explained to him that in our testimony before the Ways and Means Committee, it's been said that we pay enough overtime to hire 40 staff people at the hospital, but we can't get them, I guess.
Right. No, I believe that. It's a big shortage area. That and geriatrics are the two real holes right now in nurse specialty areas.
Okay. Well, I'm really glad to hear that OHSU is alive and well.
Thank you.
What was that Mark Twain thing? The rumors of his imminent demise were greatly exaggerated, or something like that.
Well, Chairman Morrison, we are not without challenges, certainly, but in this area, we'll continue to work with you.
Okay. Good. Questions? Comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Others wishing to testify? With that, we will close the public hearing, and we are adjourned for
Thank you.